85. Partly cloudy skies tomorrow and a high of 85 degrees. It's 72 at 11 o'clock.
Last year, the Phoenix VA was the target of intense criticism related to how long veterans had to wait for treatment. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll find out about what sort of progress has been made by the VA. Glenn Griffin, director of the Phoenix VA healthcare system, addressed a state legislative committee this morning. Plus, state lawmakers approved a budget for the fiscal year beginning on July 1st. Some longtime Capitol watchers were surprised that a budget this contentious was pushed through in March, with less time devoted to hammering it out. We'll talk about it. Also, an Arizona Daily Star investigation indicates that the University of Arizona in Tucson may be the site of a cult. We'll talk to one of the reporters and a person who studies cults to learn more. And comedian and actor Kevin Pollak first became known for impersonations of actors William Shatner and Christopher Walken. Then his Hollywood career took off with roles in A Few Good Men and The Usual Suspects. We'll find out more from Pollak. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Iraqi forces have breached one of the major strongholds of the self-proclaimed Islamic State. They say troops and Shiite militiamen have entered the city of Tikrit, which is about 80 miles north of Baghdad. Declaring that he is in utter disbelief, Secretary of State John Kerry is blasting the letter that 47 Senate Republicans sent Iranian leaders this week, in which they warn that any nuclear pact Iran makes with the Obama administration can be undone. The lawmakers believe the White House is doing too little to ensure Iran does not develop a nuclear weapon. NPR's Elsa Chang reports Kerry reacted to the missive during a hearing on the president's request for more war powers to combat ISIS.
Secretary of State John Kerry says the letter risks undermining the confidence of foreign governments that have entered into thousands of agreements with the United States.
It purports to tell the world that if you want to have any confidence in your dealings with America, they have to negotiate with 535 members of Congress. And that is both untrue and profoundly a bad suggestion to make, I think.
Kerry said that executive agreements, which don't require congressional votes, are a necessary tool of foreign policy. In the letter, Republicans had said that any deal with Iran must have congressional approval if that deal is to last beyond the Obama administration. Elsa Chang, NPR News, The Capitol.
The White House is monitoring developments off the coast of Florida, where the Coast Guard is searching for seven Marines and four soldiers. They've been missing since their Black Hawk helicopter crashed during a training mission last night off Pensacola. NPR's Debbie Elliott has the latest.
Heavy fog has hampered search and rescue efforts near Eglin Air Force Base in the Florida Panhandle. Crews have recovered some remains on the beach, and boats are working in the Santa Rosa Sound, a waterway off the Gulf of Mexico. Eglin spokesperson Sarah Vidoni.
Human remains have washed up on shore, but we do not have the number of remains at this time. And this is an active search and rescue mission.
She says an investigation is underway to determine what caused the Black Hawk helicopter to crash Tuesday night. Visibility was low because of fog. On board were four National Guard soldiers from Hammond, Louisiana, and seven Marines from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter says thoughts and prayers are with them and their families. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Service is down for many Apple, iTunes, and App Store users worldwide. Apple's still investigating the outages. This comes just days after the company unveiled its new Apple Watch and MacBook products. In the midst of today's problems, Apple stocks have been down. NASDAQ Composite Index is about 6 points lower. It stands at 48.53. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up slightly, about 2 points at 17,665. S&P 500 down a fraction at 2,043. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses succeed with email and online marketing tools, for organizations to promote their business through newsletters, events, surveys, and social media. More at ConstantContact.com.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. A federal judge says city officials can remove homeless sleeping pods from downtown Tucson. But as KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports, the city wanted more.
City officials claimed the order allows protesters to keep sleeping pods in a downtown park and asked the court to modify its order. Judge David Burry refused to change his December injunction against a city rule restricting homeless people to having only three small belongings on sidewalks. Protesters say that regulation unfairly targets the homeless population and argue they have a First Amendment right to protest at the site. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Prescott City Council has voted against appealing a retirement board's decision to grant public safety survivor benefits to families of three firefighters killed in the 2013 Yarnell Hill fire. City officials had contested the three firefighters' eligibility to receive the benefits, but the council's votes yesterday end that fight. The chairman of the Arizona Board of Regents may be ready to lead an effort to sue the legislature over its funding cuts to higher education. Mark Killian tells Capital Media Services the cuts may violate the state constitution's provision that university instruction be as nearly free as possible. Killian says the regents will discuss the possibility of a suit at their meeting in Flagstaff starting today, but House Speaker David Gowan, who helped push the budget and its $99 million cut for universities through, doesn't see it that way.
We're in a deficit. We know that. We're restructuring our budget. We're trying to get structurally balanced.
The state Supreme Court ruled in 2007 the constitutional funding argument is a political, not a legal issue. But Killian says a lot has changed since then, and the governor and state lawmakers should think twice about discounting the idea that universities could win a court fight.
KJZZ is supported by the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, hosting Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton for his annual State of the City Address, April 8th, Sheraton Phoenix Downtown Hotel. Reservations at phoenixchamber.com/mayors.
We'll see partly cloudy to partly sunny skies in the valley today, a high near 88 degrees. That's about 13 degrees above normal for today. Clear skies overnight with lows in the mid-60s and more clouds tomorrow with a high expected to be 85. It's partly sunny in Phoenix right now and 76 degrees at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, how did Arizona's budget for the fiscal year starting in July get settled so quickly? In the past, we've seen contentious proposals with strong opposition lead to votes in the wee hours in May or June, not March. I'll talk with Chad Campbell and Kurt Davis. Also, an investigative report by Tucson's Arizona Daily Star looks into whether a group at the U of A may be a cult. We'll talk with one of the journalists and someone who studies cults. Plus, comedian and actor Kevin Pollak will be in the Valley this weekend. I'll find out how he made the transition from stand-up impersonator to highly regarded actor in films like A Few Good Men and The Usual Suspects. We start today's program with word that Phoenix VA Healthcare System Interim Director Glenn Griffin addressed a state legislative committee today. Griffin spoke to the members of the Senate Committee on Public Safety, Military, and Technology. The VA came under scrutiny last year following reports that dozens of veterans died awaiting treatment at the Phoenix Veterans Affairs Medical Center, and the records were manipulated to hide delays. KJZZ's Carrie Young has covered the Phoenix VA controversy extensively and watched this morning's hearing, and she joins me now. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Carrie, what was the message from Glenn Griffin? What did he have to say?
Well, he came with a presentation, first of all, for the senators that he was speaking with, and it began just with that he was aware that there were concerns about access to care and that he had some numbers of improvement based from 2013 to 2014. Those were in primary care, they had increased those seen by 13%. In mental health, they had increased those seen by 29%. And in specialty care, it was an increase of 14%. He also discussed some of the efforts to move more primary care out to the community clinics throughout the valley here.
So what was the atmosphere like? How did the senators greet him?
The senators were happy to have him there and the opportunity to speak with him. There was, I think Senator Smith mentioned, there was some angst involved. I guess they wanted some answers on the national system. Some of those answers he couldn't really give. Senator Ward spoke a lot during this hearing. One of the things she mentioned had to do with the CHOICE program, or the program that allows veterans to go outside of the VA system for care if they live far enough away. And Arizona leads the nation in that program, but it's really only 500 people utilizing that out of the 10,000.
If it's 500 out of 10,000, it's a pretty sad to be in the lead at that number. So why can't we take that chance and let the president know that we want to be a leader? We want more for our veterans, and we want to start right here in our state in Arizona.
And President Obama is making another visit to the Valley on Friday. Last time he was in town, he was criticized for not stopping by the VA. What did Glenn Griffin have to say about what he wants the president to look into? What is he going to say to the president?
Yes, the senators asked him about that a lot, actually. But he said his message mostly to the president was going to be that of the improvements that they've made, a lot of the numbers that I mentioned earlier.
What I'm going to tell them about is our outreach to 311,000 veterans, that we're seeing many more of them. We're using our TriWest contract at maximum of anybody in the country, and we're going to see more veterans.
KJZZ's Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks.
Thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. After spending all of Friday night into Saturday morning at the state capitol, lawmakers approved a budget for the fiscal year beginning on July 1st. Cuts to higher education received the most criticism, though there were concerns about whether enough money was being put toward K-12 education as well. Some longtime Capitol watchers were simply surprised that a budget this contentious was pushed through in March, with less time devoted to hammering it out. At the end of last week, Governor Doug Ducey didn't understand those who said they thought the process was being rushed.
Slow this down. What are we waiting for? I ran on this budget. I talked about this budget in inauguration and State of the State. I stood with the Speaker and the President on January 16th. We're 7 weeks into this. Let's pass a budget. It's time to balance the budget.
And with me to talk about the budget, Governor Ducey, and the rapidly progressing 2015 legislative session is Chad Campbell, former House Minority Leader. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Kurt Davis of First Strategic. All right, Chad, considering there was a lot of opposition to aspects of this budget, as there would be for any budget, it seems odd that Governor Ducey would feel like 7 weeks was a long enough time to wait.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. But I, at the same time, I would say he's right in the fact that this isn't really a surprise to anybody who was paying attention. He said during the campaign cycle he wasn't going to raise taxes. He said he was going to reduce government and put it within its limits. It's no surprise that this is what happened, and this is what you get based off the election results last year. I think the biggest thing that's surprising to many people is you get the House and the Senate in line so quickly. But as I said after the election last cycle, I really think Annie Biggs is driving this train. He's really controlling the agenda down there, and I think it's reflective in the budget that was passed last week.
But when you have a new governor in there, do you think there's some strategy involved there, or do you think that Andy Biggs is playing the game better? Andy Biggs got a lot of criticism during the Medicaid expansion fight where he got rolled by some of his fellow members.
Yeah, and how times have changed, I guess, right? But Andy Biggs knows what he's doing down there. Andy Biggs is very smart. Him and I served together. We don't agree on much, but I respect Andy. We always got along on a personal level, and he knows how to work that system and work his caucus. And he's the most experienced person in leadership in this state now. He has more experience in the new House leadership. He has much more experience than Governor Ducey, who really hasn't had an elected position before this that had any policy capacity. So Andy Biggs is really kind of the senior member down there. And I think we're seeing Andy Biggs' dream budget right now in this state, to be very honest.
That's former State House Minority Leader Chad Campbell. And now joining us as well is Kurt Davis of First Strategic, a former gubernatorial deputy chief of staff. Kurt, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
So,
good morning, Chad.
Hey, Kurt. How you doing?
Good.
So, Kurt, what we're talking about initially here is this idea that Governor Ducey said that he seemed to be taken aback that people thought the budget was rushed through. What does this indicate to you about Governor Ducey's leadership style? And also, Chad just jumped in about how Senator Biggs seems to be in control of the agenda down there.
Well, first of all, I always respect what Chad Campbell says. He was a very effective leader, and I mean that in true regards. He was a very effective leader of the Democrats down there. I think they missed him a little this session, to be honest with you. But I guess I'm also taken aback. Budgets are always rushed through. We've never had, when you get to an agreement, you move the budget as quickly as possible, and that's not new. I mean, that's not some new new occurrence that happens at the legislature. It's part of the operating procedure. So I guess I'm too a little bit shocked that people think it's rushed.
I guess, and I'm not speaking for myself here.
By the way, it's not that dissimilar from the proposals that were put out related to the budget.
I think the one thing that got a lot of attention, both of you, is this idea that related to vehicle registration, and this was one little revenue thing that Governor Ducey seemed to advocate bringing in. And okay, in the picture of a $9 billion budget, it was what, $30 to $35 million.
Yeah,
so we can't
minuscule.
But it did seem like it was. At least those who are watching from outside did seem like, well, okay, Governor Ducey decided, it's really not worth fighting over. I mean, did you guys read it that way?
Well, the question is whether you had to achieve 2/3 of a vote to support it because it's, quote-unquote, a tax.
Yeah, and again, I think this goes back to Senate President Biggs. I think that Andy Biggs doesn't want any revenue coming to the state, new revenue at least. And I think he put the stop to that very, very quickly. And I think it goes to a bigger question, though, and I've said this for a long time now. We have to talk about revenue in this state. We have to. And I talk to people in the business community. I talk to people from all across the political spectrum. And everybody knows we have to have a revenue conversation at some point in the near future.
We can't keep doing the same thing we've been doing for the past 6 or 7 years.
And Kurt, Bob Robb's column this morning in The Republic talked about this idea of, you know, maybe another sales tax increase, or else we're going to end up with a ballot initiative. Is Chad right? I mean, is there going to have to be some sort of major discussion, whether it's there's going to be some sort of spending limit, or we're going to have to raise revenue in some sense?
No, I do think Representative Campbell is correct that there does have to be a conversation. As the state changes and its economic model changes over time, the idea that you would look at how you derive revenue to operate government services is absolutely something that should be on the table. And I think you'll also hear people that would argue that the entire school finance system has to be part of that discussion as well, because it's, you know, it's morphed and changed over a time to something that is unbelievably complex, and we probably spend way too much money on accountants and lawyers trying to figure out what it says.
And Kurt, you and I are agreeing way too much this morning. I actually agree with Kurt. The school finance has to be part of the conversation, and I've been an advocate for this for years. It's not about just increasing taxes. That's not the solution. It's about reforming our tax code, making it more reflective of our modern-day economy, which includes looking at how we derive a revenue from the service-based industry, which we just don't do right now. And we can make it a much less regressive tax code and still make it much more productive in terms of generating revenue for the state's needs.
Kurt, is there a risk that the state, and we understand, of course, that people vote for legislators. They are fairly put into office, no question. Are we running into an issue, though, in this state it is on the right, in other states perhaps it's on the left, where a certain philosophy just takes hold and there's really not that much flexibility?
Well, I think if you, and this is a huge subject that would be worthy of discussion over many hours of your radio program, but if you look at over time, the bottom line is we now have about 10 competitive legislative districts. All other districts are decided in their primaries, and primaries have, you know, 20 to 25% turnout. And that, by the way, that's the fault of voters on both sides of the equation. If they don't like what happens in those primaries, then only 20 to 25% of them show up. That's a problem. So the bottom line is that of the 90 seats, disproportionate number of them are decided in the primary, and you're going to get people that tend to have pretty strong philosophical beliefs, either on the conservative or more liberal side of the equation.
And I think that's a fair assessment of it, but I guess I keep wondering, what is it, this is perhaps not a fair example, but I think to the U.S. Supreme Court, for example, and there have been critics over the years that say, well, a president appoints someone because they expect a certain philosophy, and then once a person is in, they sort of decide, I know it's different because that's a lifetime appointment, but even this idea of I'm going to sort of see how things go, and except it does seem here that even the philosophy about a revenue increase, it's the fact that it's not even on the table. I understand why it wouldn't affect
things. Look at all if you take all the reforms, I believe they've had a chilling effect on the creation of what I would guess I would call stateswomen like legislators. You've changed redistricting. They no longer have to work with each other to draw lines, which changes the civility of the place, in my opinion. The second is we instituted term limits, which I'm a huge opponent of, because you take knowledge. People like Chad Campbell aren't there who's acquired knowledge over time. You remove him from the equation. We went to government-funded campaigns, which allow, if people can go get a few $5 checks and then they get government money to run on, I can argue very clearly that you will attract more people outside the mainstream when you create that scenario. So you take all these reforms and you throw them together, and I'm not shocked by we have a less experienced legislature that tends to be more on both sides, more ideologically driven.
And I agree wholeheartedly about term limits. I think that term limits has not done what the voters thought it was going to do. I think it's backfired. I do think the biggest problem we have, though, in Arizona, and this is true for a lot of places across the country, it goes to the district map that Kurt mentioned. Our district maps just aren't competitive enough, and they're decided in the primary elections. And in this state, of course, with the registration numbers the way they are, you're going to have a predominantly Republican and more conservatively dominated legislative body. And right now, all of the statewide offices are Republican as well. And it's not really, I think, the Republican Party of the old days. It's this new Tea Party ideology. And so, again, not having a revenue discussion, let alone actually passing something, but not even being able to talk about revenue down there is in my mind absolutely crazy, to be very honest with you. We have revenue needs. And a great example of this, and I've talked to many people in the business community who told me outright that they would support this, was suspending the corporate tax cuts that are coming online over the next couple of years. That would have got us a couple $100 million right there. I've talked to people across the state in the business community who tell me we don't need those tax cuts right now. We could have held off on them. And yet that was not even a point for discussion. And that's not a tax increase of any kind. It's just forestalling any tax cuts for the time being to save us in this time of need. And it didn't happen.
That's former House Minority Leader Chad Campbell. Also with us is Kurt Davis of First Strategic. Kurt, we'll give you a chance to respond to that after this break. We'll have more on this conversation. We'll bring it back to the current legislative session as well as Here and Now continues.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony. The Gene Kelly film Singin' in the Rain is projected above the orchestra as the Phoenix Symphony performs the classic score live. March 14th and 15th. Info at phoenixsymphony.org.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ 91.5. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now. Partly cloudy skies and 57 degrees in Flagstaff. It's 73 in Casa Grande. Sunny and 77 in Tucson. Cloudy skies, 71 degrees in Yuma. And under cloudy skies, 59 in Prescott. Well, KJZZ thanks Bradley for donating his Toyota Corolla to support his favorite shows. You can donate your vehicle too by visiting cars.kjzz.org, and thanks. If you're looking for more jazz in Phoenix, Jazz PHX is your source for classic jazz and your connection to the Phoenix jazz scene. It's at jazz.kjzz.org and on your HD radio at 91.5 HD2. Partly sunny skies in the valley right now, 17% relative humidity, and it's 76 degrees at 11:22.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with former House Minority Leader Chad Campbell and Kurt Davis of First Strategic. Kurt, let me come to you to get a response to what Chad had to say about what business people have told him about the corporate tax cuts.
Well, I think there's always arguments when, and I don't discount that there are those that believe that. Then there's another train of thought that, you know, obviously one of the primary responsibilities of the legislature and the governor's office is related to economic growth, and ultimately economic growth will drive more revenue to state government. So if you impede that growth in the private sector, you're going to long term impede the revenues that are derived to state government. So you end up in a philosophical debate, and there's a lag between the institution of tax cuts and then the benefit of when they occur. And so this always becomes a jumbled argument. I can turn around, and if I were arguing with Representative Campbell about, you know, another piece of this pie, you know, we couldn't even come to agreement, unfortunately, because we wanted to protect education bureaucracies of not driving more dollars into classrooms. I mean, that's so there's everyone's got their $100 or $200 million deal in these budget conversations. And that's just how the process goes. It's not a perfect document. If everyone liked it, it'd probably be a really bad budget. And the bottom line is there's stuff for everybody to dislike, and there's a, depending on where you are philosophically, there's things in the budget to like as well.
And I would just add to that. I would now we're disagreeing, Kurt, so here we go. So I would add this. I think that economic growth is a key responsibility for the governor's office and the legislature, but it's not happening in Arizona. We haven't seen any economic growth since Janet Napolitano left this state. We've been doing the same exact policies for the past 6 years under Jan Brewer, now Doug Ducey, and we're falling further behind. Unemployment rate's still higher than the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. We just dropped out of the top 10 best places to do business, according to some publications. We don't have an education infrastructure that is up to date and up to speed to graduate kids ready for, I think, high skill and high wage jobs. And so what we're doing isn't working in this state, and we keep doing the same thing over and over again. So it's time to rethink our policies. And I agree with Kurt, there needs to be some reform in education, don't get me wrong. But with that reform, we need to fund it, and we're not doing that in this state.
Kurt, when it comes to these cuts, are we in a position where, again, the structural deficit always comes up? And whether we take care of the structural deficit, then is there a chance to really look at reforming the system? Are these cuts really just a short-term pain for some people, and then this will give us a chance to really rework the system in a more productive way or not?
Well, I think the good thing that comes out of not doing voodoo budgets and where you're passing on and the debt that's going to be owed, the good thing that comes out of it is the cuts are deep enough that it ultimately does force conversations like Representative Campbell has brought up. That's the one of the benefits. When you paper over the actual problem, then people, the session's over and they kind of go about their day again, and then the next year they start the whole thing over again. I think in a case like this, there is an opportunity to talk about structural reform. There's also an opportunity, and when 49% of the budget goes to education, you have to talk about structural reform on that side as well. If, you always look at where you're spending your money, and if 49% of the money is being spent in that arena, then you have to look at how you're spending it. And is it getting to where you want it to get to create the kind of education system that Representative Campbell is talking about?
Just got a few minutes left in the discussion. Guys, I want to go to the politics of this because I think back again to the Medicaid expansion fight, and there was this group of what we called moderate Republicans in the state Senate. And when I look at how the budget votes went, Jeff Dial's the only one I see that voted against the budget. Adam Driggs and Bob Worsley both voted for it. Steve Pierce didn't vote, kind of a protest, I guess. What does this say, Kurt, to you, first of all, then Chad will give you a chance to talk about Republicans as well, which I'm sure you'll love. Kurt, what does this say about, is there a real faction or is there not?
Well, that's not new. There's always been I mean, I know that people talk about the Tea Party. I can talk about the Sandinista wing of the Democrat Party. I mean, there's wings in the parties. There always has been. And the art of the deal, and I think Representative Campbell, before I came on, was talking a little bit about it, Senator Biggs, President Biggs, is very effective in knowing where he's got to go to get votes. And so you're always going to have, and we spend a lot of time, quite frankly, talking about the outliers on the budget, and that's fine and it's interesting and all that. But at the end of the day, there has always been this process. This is what happened with Senator Begay is not new. This has occurred multiple times since I've been in and around this process since the 80s.
Right. Go ahead, Chad.
And I would just add, I don't disagree with anything Kurt's saying, but I think there's a bigger problem, and it's not just Arizona. This is a national issue of the fact that the two parties just aren't working together any longer. If you look at Congress, that system is broken. It's in gridlock. And if you look at the votes, you compare the votes of now compared to 20, 30 years ago, the people crossing over and voting with the other side on both sides is so diminished that it's almost impossible to get bipartisanship around big issues any longer. Same is true for Arizona and its legislature. And I'm not blaming either party. I'm not blaming anybody. I think ultimately, though, we have to figure out as a state how to return to that civic discourse, how to return to that ability to work with each other and not get chastised and attacked by our base for sometimes working with the other side. And until that happens, we're going to have this extreme partisanship and nothing else is going to get solved.
Guys, just about a minute or so left. Kurt, let me start with you. Real short answer on this. Did this particular first part of the session, the lead up to the budget, teach us anything new about Governor Ducey?
Yeah, I think it teases that he's actually a man on a mission that wants to get things done, the session done, and get to work on reform issues, and it's hard to do during the legislative process. So I think you're seeing a CEO in many ways that reminds me of the style of Fife Symington and Janet Napolitano.
Chad?
One thing I would say is his public profile hasn't been very high, though. And I hear that from people outside of the political world. I think people are used to Napolitano, who did have a higher profile, and definitely Jan Brewer had a very high profile. And Doug Ducey, I think, he's getting his feet underneath him and learning the ropes. But his profile has been pretty low throughout this process.
Former State House Minority Leader Chad Campbell, also Kurt Davis, a partner at First Strategic. Gentlemen, thanks for the time today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Kurt.
Bye.
Good morning, it's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The decades in development South Mountain Freeway has moved a large step closer to construction. The route, which will run east to west behind South Mountain and then go north between 63rd and 59th Avenues, has received final approval from the Federal Highway Administration. That allows the Arizona Department of Transportation to move the project ahead. With more information, we're joined by Eric Anderson, Transportation Director for the Maricopa Association of Governments. Eric, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. So how big a deal is this? It sure seems like it's a big deal.
Well, it's a big deal. As you mentioned, the South Mountain Freeway has been an integral part of our transportation plan for actually going back to 1985. The environmental impact statement process started on the South Mountain Freeway in 2001. And so here, 15 years later, we finally have a record of decision and approval from the Federal Highway Administration to move forward.
And the process could start as early as next year, but I know there are still folks, especially in that Ahwatukee area, who are not happy about this and still want to take some legal steps. I don't know how much you can talk to us about that, but is that a process you think could delay things?
Well, it certainly has the potential to delay things. We've expected litigation. It's not uncommon in terms of these large projects nationally. And so it's expected. Hopefully, the process that our partners, ADOT and Federal Highway Administration, went through to develop the environmental impact statement followed all the provisions of the national, the NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, and we'll have a green light from the courts to move forward, too.
So, Eric, at its core, we always talk about big transportation projects around the valley and the challenges as this place has grown so rapidly. How big an impact can this have once completed in terms of whatever it's intended to do? First of all, what are the goals of this addition, this 22-mile project, and what sort of impact can it have, and how long could that impact take to go into effect?
Sure. The South Mountain Freeway is the last segment of our Loop 202 system, so it'll complete the Loop 202 in the Phoenix area. But importantly, the major purpose of the facility is link the Southeast and Southwest Valley together economically through a good transportation corridor. So I think the impact of that, we hopefully it'll be open to traffic by 2019, 2020. And I think you'll see some pretty major impacts immediately through increased mobility in the region, and certainly will help take some of the pressure off of Interstate 10.
And is this plan based on the valley continuing to grow rapidly?
Well, yeah, that's certainly part of the equation. But, you know, since we first identified the need for this facility in 1985, you know, we've grown a lot since then. So it certainly was needed in 1985, and it's way overdue today, given all the population growth we've had subsequent to the initial inclusion of the facility in our plan.
A phrase that came up last night when the word came down was public-private partnership. Can you explain to us how that works with this one?
Yeah, and this project, because it's a critically needed facility, we've been working with the Arizona Department of Transportation on a public-private partnership opportunity to bring a design builder team in to construct the facility and maintain it for possibly up to the next 30 years. So this will be the largest design build contract, and it'll be the first big design build maintain contract in Arizona under our new public-private partnership statutes that the legislature passed back in 2009.
Eric, people who are transportation junkies love to look at the designs of the different freeways. Can you give us an idea of what this is going to look like?
Well, the facility will have three general-purpose lanes and an HOV lane, much as you see around the valley. That's actually a reduction of one general-purpose lane from the original design. In many of our planning efforts here over the last few years, we've decided to we looked at the traffic numbers, decided that if we can build a facility, get it all built at one time, obviously that minimizes the neighborhood disruption as well as the traffic disruption. So it'll be a four-lane facility, three general-purpose lanes and one HOV lane each direction, all the way from I-10 in the West Valley to the I-10 in the East Valley.
How much time could this potentially save folks in terms of when they've had to use what is currently available and what's coming online potentially in a few years?
Well, it certainly provides another opportunity. So as we all know, I-10 around the Broadway curve gets fairly congested pretty much every day and for extensive periods of day. So this provides another alternative for people to get over to the other side of the valley in a fairly good way, as opposed to sitting in traffic on I-10. Once again, we see this as a critical link in our highway system here.
Eric, finally, any high-tech things that might be related to the new stretch? Anything, any new ideas, any things that maybe people have not seen on some of the other existing freeways?
Well, in terms of the construction, I think the design build contracting team, we expect will have some innovative construction methods that could reduce the cost of the overall facility. And then at some point in the future, we're looking at a big rollout of technology, more on I-17 and sections of I-10 here in the next 3 or 4 years. And if that proves successful, that technology then will be applied pretty much system-wide. So that's better driver information, travel time information, those sorts of things. So we think technology is certainly something that we can embrace here in the region to increase mobility around the entire system without adding more lanes of traffic.
Eric Anderson is Transportation Director for the Maricopa Association of Governments. Eric, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Steve.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with the Arizona Daily Star investigative reporter about what some former members are calling a cult at the U of A. Also later on this hour, we'll talk with comedian and actor Kevin Pollak, who's in town this weekend. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, presenting a women's leadership seminar Wednesday, March 18th, offering advice on how to adjust your leadership style for influence and impact. Registration at asumba.com.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM. Partly cloudy to partly sunny skies in the valley forecast for today. We'll see temperatures substantially above average for today. The high expected 88 degrees, 75 is average. Clear skies overnight with a low of 64. Partly cloudy again tomorrow, the high dropping to 85 and then back up to 87 under sunny skies on Friday. Stay with us at noon for Here and Now from Boston. Utah lawmakers have passed a bill to allow the use of a firing squad for executions if lethal injections aren't available. And a congressman is urging Americans to prepare for terror attacks at home. NPR's Here and Now starts at 12. Skies are partly sunny right now in the valley, and it's 76 degrees at KJZZ at 11:37.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. An investigative piece ran over the weekend in Tucson's Arizona Daily Star newspaper. Reporters spoke to a number of former members of the Faith Christian Church on the University of Arizona campus who say the group operates as a cult. Joining me now is investigative reporter Emily Bragel. She co-wrote the story. Emily, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Emily, give us a little background, would you please? What is the Faith Christian Church? How long has it been on the U of A campus?
Faith Christian Church, under its current name, has been on U of A's campus since 1990. The church actually existed here before that time as Maranatha Church. It was an offshoot of Maranatha based in Florida, which was a national group of churches that all focused on recruiting on university campuses. And Maranatha shut down in 1990, in part, many say, related to allegations that they were authoritarian and could have negative impacts on the students they were recruiting.
Mm. Now, you and your colleagues spoke to more than 20 former employees and church members. What started you down this path?
We first heard from a mom in Los Angeles whose son is a junior at the U of A right now, and he had gotten deeply involved in Faith Christian Church over the past couple years, and the mom said she was getting really concerned about him. He'd changed his career plans and intended to join the church after college and become a campus minister, and had completely changed his personality and behavior, and she was actually worried that she would lose touch with him completely. So I spoke with her a few weeks ago, and when we began looking into this, very quickly we were able to find many other former members and including former staff members of the church who had just strikingly similar experiences. They echoed each other in so many ways. So we very quickly realized there was a big story there.
And what were some of the things the former church members told you that were consistent?
One thing that came up repeatedly was this idea of complete submission to church leadership. People said that they were shamed if there was any questioning of church leadership. There was financial coercion during Bible studies. People would be asked to bring information on their personal bank accounts, which they said was for leaders to be able to ensure they were tithing enough. There's also shunning of anyone who leaves the church. They would lose all their friends if they decided to leave and couldn't be in contact with the church anymore. And also alienation from parents, complete control over one's time and activities, including down to what your college major should be, what kind of car you should buy. Just so many of these things were consistent from people we talked to who are now living across the country.
How were church leaders able to draw on the former members you spoke with? Did it sound as if certain vulnerabilities were being targeted?
That is exactly what we heard from the former members and a number. We spoke to nine different parents of former members as well. And it does seem that transition times are when people are particularly vulnerable to things like this. And the church does focus on college-age students. They're very upfront with that. It's part of their tactic, they say. So a lot of these former members we talked to said they were in a vulnerable time, both because they were in a new city, had no friends, were a freshman at college, or maybe were going through some personal challenges and had a terrible breakup, and many of them said were in a vulnerable place.
You reached out to church leaders to get their response. Did you ever get a reply?
We have not gotten any reply from church leaders, and that includes Steve Hall, who is the senior pastor there, and Ann Lax, the executive pastor. And we made a lot of efforts. We sent an email with 42 detailed questions outlining all of the allegations that we included in our story. We emailed those February 23rd, and then the next day I actually hand-delivered copies of those to Mr. Lax and Mr. Hall's homes, and we snail-mailed a copy of those questions to the church's P.O. box.
Emily, finally, how did the U of A respond to what the former church members had told you? Were they alarmed by what they were hearing?
They have responded now. They have said that in the past, although they'd heard about the church, they had not gotten any formal written complaints that involved a current student. And they said they couldn't undertake a formal investigation and really do anything about it until that happened. The Los Angeles-based mom who I spoke with has issued that or submitted that written complaint. So they are now taking action to look into the church. And if they do find that the church compromises students' experiences, that could be because clubs on campus have to have a positive experience for students. So that could be a basis for them limiting their activities on campus. But the university has been wary of doing anything that could be perceived as discriminatory of any group that comes on campus.
Emily Bragel, investigative reporter for the Arizona Daily Star. She and a colleague wrote about the Faith Christian Church on the U of A campus. Emily, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Now I'm joined by Nori Muster, author of Betrayal of the Spirit. Nori, thanks very much for being with us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
Now, Nori, your experience with a group that some may describe as a cult, how did you get involved and what got you out?
Coincidentally, I was recruited on my college campus. The group was the Hare Krishnas. They were based in Los Angeles, and they opened a preaching center in Isla Vista, which was the college town for UCSB. And I was a really eager joiner, though. I wasn't. I didn't think I'd join anything. I thought I was going to finish college and go on to a career and do other things and just sort of have more faith. But the person who recruited me convinced me that that wasn't possible. In order to be on the path, I would have to join the temple and become a full-time member.
Wow. So how long were you in, and what eventually got you out?
I was in it for 10 years.
Wow.
I know. But the thing that finally made me leave was when I started to realize there was something going on in the organization that they were hiding. And that's what causes doubts in a lot of members. They start to get doubts. They start to see that their guru has clay feet. They start to see that the organization's got problems. And then they back away from it.
And there are families that actively want to get their loved ones out, but ultimately does it have to come down to the person, him or herself, to decide this is enough?
Yeah, some people will do an intervention with their children to try to get them out, and I don't recommend that. I've met people that have been through that who say it worked, but it costs a lot of money, and then it takes away the young person's or the cult member's liberty, really, that, the decision is made for them. In my case, I waited my father was, he lived really close to the temple, so I saw my father a lot. He got really involved with the group to try to stay in touch with me on behalf of the family. And he waited, he never said anything bad about the group until toward the end we both started to have doubts and we both started to see what was going on. And one day he just said, you know, you have a lot of weird men in your group, because we had been to the Venice Beach Festival. And I was like, you know, you're right, Dad. And we just gradually, we talked it out. He didn't try to force me to leave.
How scary is it, though, or could it be for parents who are so afraid of losing their child even more to sort of let nature take its course?
Yeah, well, my dad was a really patient, kind of unusual, unique person. But it is really scary for families because it's like their loved one has died. Yeah. The non-cult family can't understand what's going on. Their loved one is talking with all kinds of weird cult rhetoric. They don't speak English anymore. They get this glazed look in their eye. It happened to me. I was like that.
Fred, as someone who's been in and out, do you understand when people who are not in sort of think, boy, how did you get sucked into that? Why were you in it?
Yeah, well, I have a lot of regrets. If I could do it over, I don't know, I might do it over. I had some good experiences, too. I've been out for 26 years, and it shaped my life. It marked my life. And then I wrote a memoir about it, which marks your life even more, because now we have Google, and anyone who puts my name in the search engine will come up with my whole resume. But my whole dream was to become an online teacher once the internet came out, and now I work at Mesa College at teaching real estate online.
Okay.
So I have been able to overcome that stigma, but it was really hard. I mean, I applied for a lot of jobs teaching, and I think they would Google me and just like, she's a Manson girl.
Wow. You know? It's Here and Now in KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with Nori Muster about cults. Nori, how do you define what a cult is? And from your perspective, at least, are all cults inherently dangerous?
Well, a cult, the word cult is really pejorative, and scholars don't like to use it because it's like pointing a finger if you call something a cult. So I use the word dangerous cult.
Okay.
Because that defines more clearly what I mean. Like you could say a cult was, you know, a homeowners association or a stamp collectors group or something. But a dangerous cult is defined by a charismatic leader who is not really a very good leader. He's immature or has other kind of motives, who gathers a bunch of people around him, controls them, gets a lot of gratification from having followers. And then I define a dangerous cult by how deeply the group is into crime or abuse or emotional abuse or unethical behavior. So if it's a benign cult, a lot of religions are benign and a lot of groups are benign. You know, a good group is marked by, you know, allowing people to have individuality, make their own choices, good communication, clearly defined roles. People, you know, the thing about a cult is you go into it and you get stuck in it. And they take away your freedom. They use the word brainwashing, but again, that's another pejorative word that scholars don't like to use.
When it comes to dangerous cults, is there resentment, backlash that comes about toward the leader once a person has left a cult? Or at that point, is it just, I'm free of it, I'm not going to worry about it anymore?
It depends on the cult. Like Scientology, we don't want to get you guys in trouble, but if you leave Scientology, they will harass you. They'll search your garbage. They'll park in front of your house. Sometimes they send thugs to... Well, I don't want to get you guys in trouble, but anyway...
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Some cults are worse than others. The cult I was in, the group I was in, was pretty nice to me when I left. They were actually glad when I left because I was writing their newspaper and they didn't like what I was saying about them. I was doing editorials and interviewing the leaders and doing all this kind of journalism they didn't like. They wanted it to just be a nice portrayal of the group, like a PR publication. So when I left, they were like, yay, goodbye. But then I wrote a book, so they, you know.
Nori, do dangerous cults, in the case of the leaders you're talking about, who are bad folks, at least to many, do they, those leaders themselves, consistently believe the message, or are they playing a role just to persuade others?
Oh, it depends. Some cult leaders start out really sincere, and they actually believe in what they're doing, but then they become really infatuated with themselves. They become narcissistic, and they lead the group off track. Other cult leaders start off just wanting power and money, and they're like psychopaths. You know, they'll do anything to anybody to get what they want. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on the group.
How much do you think this inherently just has to do with how we are as human beings and whether some people have vulnerabilities, others just want to feel like they're going to make their own choice and not have people tell them what to do, and ultimately things can get dangerous or not depending on how a person can handle things?
Yeah, that goes back to the study of cults. People don't understand what a cult is. It's really just the dark side of human behavior. It's like on the playground. You have children. Hey, that's my ball. Give it back. I'm not going to play with you. You're bad. You know, it's just that's the behavior. That's the level of behavior in a cult. That's the level the leaders are on. That's the followers, that's a whole mixed bag of who joins cults. But yeah, it's just bad human behavior, and then they call it a cult. Yeah. So, or identification with the aggressor is another way to put it.
Nori, last thought for you. Based on the studies you've done and the experience you've had, does it feel like cults are more or less prominent? Is it sort of the same as it's always been?
I think there's more cults, but they're smaller and lesser known. I think people learn, the big cults are still around, like the Unification Church and Scientology, Hare Krishna. They're still around, but people are a little more wary of them, but they'll join like this one in Tucson. They'll think, oh, well, it's a Christian group. It can't be bad. But cults will take any philosophy and just turn it into a poisonous thing.
Nori Muster is author of Betrayal of the Spirit. She's been talking with us about cults as a follow-up to an investigative piece that ran in the Arizona Daily Star newspaper in Tucson. Nori, thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Kevin Pollak began establishing his Hollywood acting career in the early 1990s, thanks to pivotal roles in films like A Few Good Men and The Usual Suspects. But Pollak's earliest breaks came thanks to late-night talk show impersonations of celebrities like William Shatner.
Something strange has happened. Since passing through a cosmic cloud, I've noticed a peculiar change in the behavior of my crew, although the faces seem the same. Their personalities have altered, yet somehow they seem familiar.
Pollak still does some stand-up, some producing, and a lot of acting. He's also been hosting an internet talk show called Kevin Pollak's Chat Show. He'll be at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts on Saturday night at 8 for a live version of the chat show. The featured guest will be actor Matthew Perry, best known for playing Chandler Bing on Friends. I started by asking Pollak what got him interested in being an interviewer instead of an interviewee.
I just basically was visiting a internet mini mogul jerk who had a big office and took me on a tour, and in that tour was a little studio space, and I walked into it, and I had never thought of the following words in this order prior to saying it out loud to him, which was, I think I want to do a Charlie Rose, but fun from here.
Okay.
And unfortunately for me, he said, how soon can you start? And that will be 6 years ago next week. I booked the show myself. You know, I've always been fascinated, I guess, with people's journey. How did you get from there to here? After reading a lot of biographies growing up, I guess this was a developing interest of mine without knowing that I would ultimately want to be the one doing the interviewing, having been interviewed by not only Charlie Rose, but Johnny Carson, and dating back to Merv Griffin, I think was my first in 1984, I want to say.
So you'll be having Matthew Perry, I understand, at the Scottsdale show you'll be doing. People may know you on screen with him from The Whole Nine Yards and whatnot. And he's had an interesting personal journey, whether it's people who read the gossip stuff or just in general and challenges that he's had, how in-depth can you guys go, the fact that you know each other pretty well?
We do have a wonderful history. We've done maybe four films together now. There's still a fascination for me, and that's the good part. And for me, it'll be about, as always, having a fun conversation with the guests, and then you, the audience, are privy to it.
Are you someone who needs to stay sort of motivated to do new and different projects all the time to keep your juices flowing, whether creatively or just intellectually?
I wish I had caught on to this sooner, but my mantra about 8 years ago became, if you're not creating, you're waiting. You know, it ties into being proactive in your life and profession, and it ties into the old adage, this is not a dress rehearsal. And I think our destiny is what we create and what we make. I joined the Writers Guild years and years ago, over 25 years ago, really just because I was like fifth lead on a sitcom, a short-lived sitcom, pitched the showrunner an idea that was really just about boosting an episode for my character. And he loved the idea and said, do you want to write the episode? And I hadn't thought about doing that. So that was like when the actor's at an audition and the director says, you'll need to ride horseback. Do you ride? And the actor says, I've got a saddle in my trunk. You know, you diversify out of necessity.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with comic, actor, director, producer, writer Kevin Pollak. He'll be at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts Saturday night at 8. He'll be doing his chat show live. Kevin, you've been a supporting actor in some huge films that have enormous followings, like A Few Good Men, Usual Suspects, Casino. Which of them had the biggest impact, you think, on your career and actually as well how you saw yourself as a performer?
I think A Few Good Men was certainly the crossing the goal line. I'd done Avalon and Barry Levinson, extraordinary, beautiful film. But A Few Good Men was me being brought up to the majors, as I describe it, in the sense that everyone else is famous in the lead cast, and my character, as written by Aaron Sorkin, is sort of the conscience of the piece also. And that was the moment in 1992 when it came out that I went from auditioning to getting offers. So for any actor, that would be a threshold that is unparalleled, because the auditioning process, as I wrote about in the one book I put out called How I Slept My Way to the Middle, that's right. That's a correct response. If nothing else, I have a funny title. But I spoke about the auditioning process, which is basically designed to fail. It makes no sense. And now that I'm directing, I just cast people. I don't audition them just because, well, look, if I want you for a role, or I'm considering you for a role, I only need to look at the body of your work to know whether you can act. And then if you can act, you can kind of do anything, as the rule goes. More specifically, if I offer you the part, the enthusiasm, but also the confidence you'll have as a performer and an actor will allow you to bring the best to the words and the scene.
I remember the first time I saw you on the late night shows, you do these spot-on impersonations, I think of William Shatner, I think of Peter Falk, of course known for playing Columbo. Was that a way for you to get known in the business? Did you enjoy doing impersonations? Because it seems like some performers kind of get tired of being asked to do that one that you did so well.
It was a freak gift I had as a kid. And it was the beginning of my stand-up comedy career at age 20 in San Francisco. Because it came so naturally, I just sort of leaned into it. Next thing I knew, it was an act instead of making my friends laugh at school. Now I have arguably the queerest brag you've ever heard, and that's the politically correct use of the term, because if you Google Christopher Walken impersonation, as many as several hundred thousand search answers will come up. I'm number one.
Wow.
If that's not the queerest brag you've ever heard, Steve, I don't know what is. But because there's five pages on YouTube dedicated to Asians doing Christopher Walken, so you see my point. So would I mind doing Christopher Walken at a drop of a hat? No, I wouldn't. In fact, let's give you the opportunity to ask Chris anything you'd like right now, keeping in mind, though, all of his thoughts are completely disconnected. Please proceed.
Mr. Walken, recently you decided to take on a role in the new NBC Live version of Peter Pan. How did you decide that you and Captain Hook had a lot in common?
Picasso was a hack.
painting noses and ears on the side of your face. I don't understand. Frankenstein, if I may, never scared me. Marsupials, they scare me because they're fast and they dart. That's crazy. I remind you, all of his thoughts seem completely disconnected.
Yes. Kevin Pollak, he is an actor, director, producer, comic, also talk show host. Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts on Saturday night. He'll be doing his show at 8, his chat show live, and his special guest will be actor Matthew Perry. Kevin, real pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for putting up with my questions.
My pleasure, and thank you for your interest and research. Nicely done, sir.
And thanks very much to you for listening to today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Another big thank you to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance. If you missed any